We're talking with Keith McCloskey about his excellent new book, The Lighthouse, The Mystery of the Elan Moor, Lighthouse Keepers, Three Men Who Vanished from the Face of the Earth, a variety of theories over the years, but nobody has solved this mystery. In fact, the police didn't even investigate it, possibly due to some political pressure by the big shots who ran the lighthouse industry in those days. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines after I talk about another mystery that Keith has investigated, the Dyatlov Pass mystery, which was perhaps even more sinister than the one we're discussing. We'll get an update on that, then see what's on your mind with some questions here on Coast to Coast AM. Keith, you mentioned that you had interviewed a number of lighthouse keepers, guys who had been in the industry a long time. Do they have a favorite theory? Is there a sort of a thread that runs through the interviews that you heard from them?
Well, they all seem to have their own views on it. One of the strongest ones is the wind. Muirhead, when he did his report, said that if they'd been caught by the wind, they would have had time to throw themselves down before they were carried over the other side of the island. But the thing is, they would have had to have got down to the west side of the island in the first place. Another theory from another keeper was that the men had gone out to attend to the trolleys out in the yard, making a hell of a racket, and the wind would have carried them literally off their feet and out over the cliff on the other side because it was very close to it. Now, you might think that's all a bit fanciful, but one of the keepers I spoke to weighed 16 and a half stone, and he was telling me he was carrying a fridge at one lighthouse station, and the wind lifted him off his feet and took him about 12 or 15 feet with the fridge. So the wind is quite capable of doing that.
Help me interpret 16 stone.
Oh, sorry. 230 pounds.
Yeah.
220, 230 pounds with a fridge.
That's a pretty good wind.
His feet and the fridge.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful. So they all have their own individual theories. There's not really a prevailing one.
Well, no. I mean, some of them had mentioned that it probably was the wave, but one other one said he was sure it would be murder with Donald MacArthur losing his temper at the. He said he felt like killing a principal he'd worked with on more than one occasion. He said, he actually had to really grit his teeth and hold his fists not to attack him. And if you look through the archives, there's plenty of records of attacks between the keepers where some were dismissed, others were fined. So, you know, it was a volatile atmosphere. But they all have their own theories.
I know you're sort of the objective observer. Have you committed to a position? I know you explore a whole bunch of different theories. Is there one that you lean toward?
Well, I don't necessarily go along with the giant wave. I've got a feeling it was something to do with Donald MacArthur. But, you know, it's just a theory. That's where I lean, because he was highly volatile and known to snap, and he had a hell of a temper. It's quite possible that he attacked the principal and then did away with Marshall at the same time, or there could have been a fight by the cliff edge, which is what the theory I put in the book. But it's a strange old place. You know, I keep an open mind. I had a weird feeling about the place when I was out there. You know, when I was coming back on the boat, I was looking back. The sun was just going down behind the islands. It's a melancholy place. And if any of your listeners go onto my author's website, I'll put pictures there so you can get a good idea of what the place is like.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely get the sense of the creepiness that you describe from the photos in the book. Tell me this, what happens to the families of these guys? I mean, wives and young children, they're not well off. This must have been crushing to them.
Hard times, basically. You know, they were given a small pension by the Lighthouse Board, but it wouldn't have been enough to keep you in luxury, that's for sure. You know, people led hard lives in those days. You know, they didn't want to lose their jobs, and these were the main breadwinners. Thomas Marshall had a father that he used to send money to. The father tried to get some money from the Lighthouse Board. They wouldn't give it. Basically the main breadwinner of the family's gone. So, you know, they had to make do, rely on friends and relatives. It's not like it is nowadays with massive compensation. It was hard times.
Let's shift gears for a moment, and then we'll take a couple of calls with questions about the lighthouse. Dyatlov Pass. We were greatly entertained by the book and the last time you were here and told us about that. But since then, you've been up there, right?
Yeah, I spent 10 days up there in August. I went up there with the chairman of the Dyatlov Foundation. And it was an expedition. There was quite a few of us. And it was very, very interesting because it gave you a different perspective to actually see the locations. And I have to say, the first thing that struck me was everything they did seemed very logical, because when we went down from where the tent was located to where the bodies were found, the bodies were actually, where the snow shelter was much closer to the cedar tree. I thought it peculiar that they were so far apart from each other. They weren't. They were much, much closer, which said to me there's a kind of logic to what they did. But it's finding out why they left the tent is the crux of it. And that there's been a new development in that, which I don't know if you want me to talk about
yeah,
it here or whether
sure.
you've got time.
Yes.
But, well, all the films the from the cameras of the group that were recovered, they've been examined with a microscope, a powerful microscope, 1,000 magnification. And it turns out that three of them were taking pictures of something in the sky at the end. It looks like lights, which were getting bigger.
Whoa.
And Zolotarev, there's a strip of film, and nine of the frames are missing. But in it, in the biggest, the biggest light orb you can see, you can actually make out the heads of three people in front of him. So at least four of them, probably five, were outside the tent looking at something in the sky, a light. So
I should mention, for the sake of those listeners not familiar with this story, this is an incident back in 1959. A group of hikers in the Ural Mountains, they're up there, it's cold, and something greatly disturbed them. Some of them were found without clothes on, some of them, I think, up trees. Some of them were kind of, the tents were shredded. It's just a very weird mystery that's never been solved. A variety, like with the lighthouse mystery, a variety of possible explanations have come out, but none really that seem to answer all the questions. And this new information, I mean, this is new to me, Keith. Has it been
yeah.
publicized?
No. Well, it's the work was carried out by Yuri Konsevich of the foundation and Valentin Yakimenko. He was in the original search party, and he was actually took over as chairman of the tourist club at the university, so he knew the group as well. He's retired now, but he and Yuri have gone through all the negatives with a powerful. It was actually Valentin Yakimenko that did the work, but as he says, we've now got something concrete because the film from three different cameras shows something in the night sky. So it's not just one camera. Three of them are identifying some kind of light object in the sky that's getting larger and larger, coming towards them. So the big question now is, what was it? As Yakimenko says, we've now got something concrete, but what is it? And that's going to be the subject of my next book.
Oh my gosh, that's yeah. I can't wait for that. You got to come back and talk to us about that one.
Definitely, yeah.
I can't imagine the circumstances why a helicopter would be out there. That place,
well, it's somebody's put that forward as a theory. Whatever it is, Zolotarev took several pictures, and for him to have round the camera on, it must have happened over a period of minutes. So a rocket or a missile, it would have gone too fast. So it's something much slower, but it's getting larger. And as I say, it appears on three different cameras, three different films. So it's quite exciting, really. I was going to say, if anybody, just go back to the actual Dyatlov Pass itself, on my Dyatlov incident website, I've taken loads of pictures. So if you want to see what it's like, albeit in the summer, and I put some videos of what it's like in the winter. They can go on the website and have a look of what the place is like, so you might get a better sense of it.
Yeah, we have a link to Keith's website, which has sublinks to his other work. If you have not read about the Dyatlov Pass, it's a fascinating mystery, and is well worth your time. I have other questions on both of these things, but maybe we'll go to the phones now, Keith, and then if we have time, I'll come back to my questions. A first-time caller, Bobby in Oklahoma. Hi, Bobby. You're on with Keith McCloskey.
Hi. How's it going?
All right. What's on your mind?
Oh, I was listening to you guys while I was on the phone, and the hikers incident, I actually watched a documentary about that, and the bodies that were found were, like, completely mangled and, like, beaten by something very strong. So a lot of whenever I was looking at the pictures, I was looking for footprints, but everybody that was there taking pictures of the aftermath had already made a lot of footprints, so I couldn't really tell what was what. So, but my actual question was about the lighthouse. The supernatural aspect of it, do you say that there was an actual graveyard on the actual island itself?
Well, it's bodies were buried there, Bobby. It's not a graveyard as such, but bodies were taken out there, and they're obviously still, you know, there'll be skeletons out there, but nobody wants to disturb it. But fowlers used to go out there, and they felt it was such a holy place, they would, before they would start killing birds, they would get on their knees and make prayers before they actually started doing their hunting of the birds. But, you know, the bodies are there. There'll be skeletons actually under the soil. But it's not a formal graveyard. This was in pre-Christian times when the bodies were taken out there, quite ancient.
Keith, Bobby, hang on for a second. Keith, has any anthropology team been out there to check out to analyze any bones? I would think it'd be interesting to see if there was any legitimacy to the stories about pygmies.
Well, they've done digging. They found what they believe to be a chapel in the north of Lewis, where the pygmies had some place of worship. But people have said that these were just bones of, you know, birds and animals, small animals. So, but the thing about going out to the island itself is quite apart from the difficulty of getting onto it, is getting permission to go onto it, because it's privately owned. It used to be the Northern Lighthouse Board only owned the actual lighthouse itself. And they're not keen on having anybody there. You know, it's a story they don't particularly, you know, want to broadcast. But you need to get permission to go onto the island. I mean, people go out there anyway, but it's privately owned now, so it's not a place you can just go digging up.
And Bobby, you were asking about Dyatlov. I don't know if you were trying to get more information about prints in the snow or in the area, but Keith, were there any prints of any kind that would indicate prior to the rescue operations getting there that other people or animals had been in the area?
Well, there are prints. There were prints there, but you see, the trouble is when the first search parties arrived, there was talk that there was the footprints of the group going down. They say seven in one lot, and two sets of footprints had wandered out from the other footprints, and they all joined up again towards the bottom. But there's been a few people have really smashed that to pieces by saying, well, when they found the tracks, they came up and people were walking up and down, the footprints all got obliterated anyway. But the trouble is, it's all so long ago, it's hard to get anybody to give a definitive answer. They took photographs of footprints there, you know, that had been made by supposedly by the group, but there's other people who have been up since then and tried to recreate what happened, and they've said that the prints disappeared within 24 hours.
So Bobby, thank you for the Bobby, thanks for the call. Welcome to the program, by the way. We now go to the west of the Rockies, Robert in Fairbanks, Alaska. Hi, Robert. You're on with Keith.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got quite the little story here. I was just wondering, you were talking about the little people, and Did they happen to see any tracks of the little people found there that they assumed could have been around as part of the lore with the three lighthouse people and the fact that there were three ravens or dark big blackbirds? Because I was kimaking, dog mushing in the Arctic of Canada in 1992 from Copper Mine all the way around through the Arctic Circle, the Arctic Ocean, up to Boothia Island, to Iglulik, to Grease Fjord, to Greenland and back. But on my one of my stops into a community called Joahaven, which is up in the center part of northern Canada and the Northwest Territories now called Nunavut, I was talking to, I speak three dialects of Inuktitut, but I was talking to an old Inuit hunter, and he said back in the 50s, he was out hunting seals on the sea ice. And while he was sleeping that night in his igloo, he was attacked by a polar bear that had come to obviously smelt the seal, and that's their favorite delicacy. But he was attacked, and as the polar bear came through, he shot at the bear, but the bear mauled him. He passed out, and when he awoke, he had found himself in a cave. Now, he was laying on the polar bear hide that he shot, but the bear had been totally skinned out, and he looked at himself and his chest. He took off his caribou hide anorak, and where he was clawed by the polar bear, he had been sewn up with the sinew of the polar bear. And he, while he was in and out of his consciousness healing, he thought he had seen what he'd seen and described as little people. Some were about a foot and a half to two and a half foot, biggest at height. And when he finally awoke out of his delirium and consciousness, he realized that being in this cave, he saw tons of prints, but he had no longer seen any more of these little people. Now, the legend from the Inuit is that while the back in the early days when the Kablunas, the Kablunaks, came to the Arctic, and that name is for the whale hunters, the ones with the big stomachs, they called them, because the drinking and overeating. But most of the whalers they had run into were, you know, a little obese, so they called them Kabluna, which means the ones with the extended big stomachs. Now, did you run into anybody who said they'd seen any of these little tracks?
No, but it's interesting. The thing about the little people in that story is they were wanting to help. The little people that inhabited these islands were quite malevolent. They didn't want to help anybody. They were the exact opposite. They didn't want to be bothered. And your story reminds me of a story that was said about a man who had been marooned on Elan Moor in the 1700s, and he said he was going to freeze to death, and he said a small man appeared in front of him and told him there was a fire in the stone chapel, and he went into the stone chapel and there was a fire there that just kept going, and it kept him alive. But that contradicts, if you like, the story of the little people. It's the same sort of story in that somebody appeared to him. But the little people in those islands were generally quite aggressive. And what I would say, rather than tracks, the overwhelming feeling I got there was a kind of a force that you couldn't see, if you like, a kind of a spirit, if you like. But there was a feeling about the place rather than anything physical.
Hey, Robert, hang on the line. We're going to take a break. We might continue this conversation on the other side, then get to some other calls. That was a pretty interesting story. Our conversation with Keith McCloskey continues about his new book, The Lighthouse, about the Dyatlov Pass, and anything else on your mind right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Keith McCloskey about his new book, The Lighthouse, about these three lighthouse workers who vanished off the face of the earth, and the mystery surrounding that disappearances, as well as the Dyatlov Pass, that very strange incident from 1959. We'll continue our calls from you listeners in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. I wanted to get one more comment from Robert in Fairbanks, Alaska, before he left us. Robert, I was wondering about that great story you told with the polar bear and the little people. Is that a commonly known story among the native people there, or is that one that's you just heard offhand?
No, it's well known around the, with the Inuit people up there.
I'm thinking that that maybe Keith needs to talk to you, Robert, or share emails or something, because that sounds like it could be a pretty good book.
Well, with his recollection and his crossings with them, they weren't mean or anything. They were nice. I think any dealings across the pond, kind of thing, up in the rocks and the Rocky, you know, Finland, Sweden, Scotland, all those areas, the Inuit would say, the Kablunaks, their first instinct is to shoot instead of investigate at strange things, right?
Sure.
And the Inuit are investigators and are little people themselves, mostly smaller than most men in stature. I mean, you get the big ones now with the hormones and the food, but typically most Inuit people are 5 feet or so and smaller, a lot of them. And people who live off the land up there respect everything. And like I said, prayers are told and whatnot. But I've also been to the first stone church ever built up there by the Jesuits in a community called Nansibalik, which is known in English as Pelly Bay, which is about a day and a half dog sled ride from Joe Haven, where I was at. And I've spent some time with the people up there, sealing and walrus and whaling. Over the course of the years, I've gone back and forth, and I taught actually what's called hotel courses in 22 of the 28 Inuit and Native communities in the Arctic, and heard quite a few stories. But with my native belief, I'm an American Indian from South Dakota, but I spent 25 years in Canada at the end of Wounded Knee, the second one. We were forced to leave the reservation. Anyways, I think when those people came to the lighthouse and discovered the three blackbirds, as they call, which I would assume were large ravens, in the native lore and culture, is those three people went missing were actually waiting. And that's who was up there, was the ravens, which are them, reincarnated. They hung around till people came to realize that they were gone. And after the investigation was done and they realized these three people weren't there and they didn't realize how they went missing, what happened, I would assume, have you ever seen the movie Shadow of the Wolf?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, yeah. Do you know what happens to the shaman when he gets in the airplane?
He shapeshifts.
Well, I think that's exactly what happened to them.
Hey, Robert, thank you. That was a great story, great information. Send me an email. We'll be in touch. Send me an email. Keith, you've been all over the world. It seems like stories about little people interacting with humans is common everywhere.
It certainly does, yeah. I mean, when I first started looking at this story, I wasn't aware that there had been what was known as little people up there, but they have their own name in Gaelic, you know, which is the language of the islands up there. They're called Lusbarden, Lusburden in the old language. But, you know, there was a name given to them, so they obviously inhabited that area. But it's interesting what Robert was saying, because they're wondering where they came from, and they believe they came from Finland or Ireland. But with what Robert's saying there, it's quite interesting, that link with the Inuits as well.
I appreciate the call. We're going to go east of the Rockies. Bernadine in Toledo. Good morning, Bernadine.
Hi. I'm going to make this quick because I was disconnected once, so I'm going to be real quick.
No problem.
Keith, I have a question. When the party came to discover that these men were missing, and you said the railings were cut away from wherever that was, there was damage to the...
Yeah, torn out.
Part of the lighthouse. Was there any indication inside the lighthouse that maybe a wave had caused damage inside the lighthouse? And second of all, I live in Toledo, which is on Lake Erie, Great Lakes, seen many, many, many storms. And I know you were talking about the Edmund Fitzgerald. Lake waves are so different than sea waves.
Yeah.
Way different. So, and I've seen some huge waves. I don't know if I would assume that a wave that big could wash away three men without causing damage inside the lighthouse. I'll listen to your response off air.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brandon.
So, yeah, that's kind of a good point. If a wave had been big enough, that kind of a super wave, you might see evidence of it in the lighthouse itself, and I don't think there was any, was there?
No, the lighthouse was further up. The lighthouse was, the actual light itself was at 285 feet. The wave that hit where the ropes were was 110 feet, but a 110-foot wave is still a massive wave. And I've never heard of anything much bigger than that. You know, even to get a 90-foot wave these days is highly unusual. I mean, they exist, but to have hit the lighthouse, the wave would have had to have been nearer 200 feet.
We'll go to Frank in Arkansas on the wildcard line. Hi, Frank. Good morning. You're on with Keith McCloskey.
Yes. The question I have pertaining to three men in the lighthouse, like you could also apply to the hikers in the past. Has anybody entertained the thought of bringing in psychics or channelers or remote viewers to investigate the situation? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Keith, what do you make of that?
I didn't catch exactly what you said at the end there.
He's trying to ask whether or not or any investigators into, I guess, either of these mysteries have tried sort of a psychic approach to see if psychics or remote viewers could get a handle clues.
I have had a psychic, and it's on my website, has actually looked at the photographs and given her explanation of it. So if you go in onto my Dyatlov website, you'll see that a psychic has given her view of what happened, which is she believed there was people outside the tent speaking in a foreign language, and she gives some of the words. So it's quite a long, detailed explanation. It's on the website if you want to have a look. So it's been done with Dyatlov, but it's worth looking at, certainly, for the Flannan Islands, because there's such a feeling there that anybody who's probably more aware than, say, the average person would probably pick up something. It's definitely worth. But the only trouble with the Flannan Islands is it's getting so difficult to get onto it now that unless the weather is completely calm, it's almost impossible to get on without a helicopter.
Well, I appreciate that. If any of the psychics and remote viewers who listen to the program want to get involved and take a stab at it, we'd like to hear from you. You know, you mentioned about the island today. I guess there's no inhabitants, right? Are there any of those islands that are inhabited?
No. They're all uninhabited and very difficult to get onto. They're totally remote. And the only time really to make an approach is in the summer, you know, when the weather's better.
Yeah, I guess, you know, you couldn't live there because there's no food. There's no game to speak of, and right?
No, you'd need everything brought out to you, which is why they had the relief ship going out once a month with food and supplies. I mean, you could collect rainwater maybe, but it would be a very harsh existence.
You mentioned in the book, and it's sort of, I don't know, it's kind of sad that the lighthouse industry has changed so much that there are no lighthouse keepers, certainly not of like the ones you describe in this book anymore. Somebody must work them or check them, even though they're automated.
It's all technical now. You have engineers, electrical engineers, go out, you know, on a regular basis by helicopter. All the lighthouses are completely automated, so they're checked on a regular basis to make sure they're all working and the machinery is okay. I mean, the actual stations themselves are still there, you know. I mean, somebody could live there, but it's a way of life that's disappeared now forever, sadly. And there's only two lighthousemen left who actually served on the Flannans. The lighthouse there was automated in 1971, and there's only two men left who actually served on it. And once they're gone, that'll be it. There'll be nobody with a memory of what it was like to work there.
One of the people that you interview, I think, for the book, Nori Muir is the name, and there's an appendix in your book. What's the basic take that this person shared?
Well, he was out there in the early 1960s. He thinks that they something had, or he said, lighthousemen are very curious people, and he feels that that something had aroused their interest that afternoon, that they should, normally would have been asleep or resting in the afternoon, but that something had piqued their interest, and that they had, two of them had gone out to see what it was and gone down towards the landing, and that they were taken away by the wave, and the third one, wondering what had happened to the other two, had gone down, after a while, and he was taken away as well. But it doesn't explain why he would have left his outdoor gear behind him, because by that time the weather was building up to storm force.
I remember somewhere in the book the story being told, one witness claiming to have seen three men in a rowboat leaving that island. Tell that part of the story and tell us what you make of that.
Shortly after the tragedy, a ship had been passing close to the Flannans, and it was a relatively calm night, and he said he saw three men in a rowing boat rowing away from the island, and he shouted out to them that they need help, and he said they ignored him and they just carried on. They slightly changed their course and carried on, and because they didn't respond to his shouts, he assumed they didn't want to be disturbed or helped in any way. But he said it was three men. He said they didn't seem like ghosts. He said they seemed like, sort of three fishermen, or they were three normal men, so there was no ghostly apparition. And he just thought it odd that they should be out at night time in a rowing boat from the island. But, it could be something supernatural that he saw.
Well, it would be pretty tough for three guys to navigate those waters in a rowboat, I would think.
Well, there was nowhere to put a rowboat. That's the other odd thing, because it's sheer cliff. Even if you kept a rowing boat down the lower side of the rocks, it'd be smashed to pieces in no time at all because of the waves there. It's just constant bad weather around those islands.
One of the stories you tell in the book, one of the crypto creatures that you mentioned by name is the Beast of Stronsay, which is a great name. What is that, and how does that
fit
into
the story? Nobody knows exactly what it was. The thing is, people say it was a basking shark, but it was about a third size, again, bigger than a basking shark. It had been washed up on the Orkney Islands, and it had been seen by a fisherman, and he measured it. It was a rotting carcass, and he measured it, and it was 55 feet long. And the biggest basking shark up there is usually around 40 feet, but it had a long neck, which gave it a kind of a serpent-like neck, which was odd. And, other people saw it as well, and it was eventually washed away by the tide. But it was called the Stronsay Beast because it was presumed to have inhabited the islands up there. So, even with a cryptoid-type animal, they would have had to have been close to the waterline for any animal like that to get at them. Because, as I say, again, it was such a difficult place to get onto.
And there's also a piece of folklore that you mentioned about an outlaw named St. Frangus. Is that a real person?
Well, yeah, he was an outlaw, and he was considered a saint, and you wonder, how do you put the two together? I mean, I suppose the old story of Robin Hood, rob the rich, so to rob somebody is a crime, but to give it to the poor isn't. He must have been of that type of person, but he clashed with the little people up there and they hanged him. So he came to a sticky end in the north of the island. But there's not much known about it. It's just known that St. Frangus was killed by the little people for displeasing them.
I thought you had a fascinating angle in that the other name for the Flannan Isles is the Seven Hunters, and that there are sort of magical connotations there. Tied to Arabian Nights. What's the connection?
Well, it's tied in with the Arabian. I mean, the Seven Hunters was just the name given to it by the local fishermen. But
you know, that they connected it with the, one of the stories in the Arabian Nights, but it's all tied in with the mysticism of it. There's no direct connection, but it's considered, you know, even when I was talking to a man who'd spent most of his life at sea, he said he found people from those islands to be very superstitious. But I mean, if you're a seaman, you're very superstitious anyway, you know, don't sail on Friday the 13th and all this sort of thing. But he said he found the people from those islands to be extra superstitious, if you like, very wary of, you know, the sea or, you know, strange omens. But he said people from the Outer Hebrides, he said many of them struck him like that. You know, the whole place is sort of cloaked in this kind of supernatural, you know, the mysticism of the place. They have their own language up there. And it was a place that was separate to the rest of Scotland for many years because, you know, the church had a strong grip on the place as well.
We'll take one more call. First-time caller, Bill in Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Bill. You're on with Keith McCloskey.
Hello. I was wondering if how long or how often the foghorn sound in a lighthouse goes off, and if that, if, after listening to that for hours and hours, could kind of, you know, make you nuts.
Well, it's funny you should say that, Bill, because one of the lighthousemen I was talking to said that when you first hear it, you don't go anywhere near it, but he said it, the whole building just reverberates with the sound of a foghorn, and obviously it's not on all the time, but he said you learn, if you're talking, you learn to speak, you time your, if you're having a conversation with somebody, you tune it out, and you actually automatically speak in bursts between the foghorn, so that when the foghorn goes off, you've stopped your sentence, and the other bloke, the other guy can reply, and then you, when the foghorn goes again, you reply to him. He said, you just get used to it. He says it can actually, if you're close to it, you can actually damage your eardrums. It's so loud. But he said you learn to live with it. But I don't know if I'd be able to do it. I must admit.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it. I suppose that there must be some piece of evidence that could help solve this, but it would seem remote to even hope for it, bones or remains or some kind of scraps of clothing.
You need to find the bodies.
Yeah.
You know, it's been 100, funnily enough, we're just past December the 15th, just a week ago virtually, and you need the bodies, but of course, to find bodies now would be, you know, unless they were buried. But, you know, the likelihood is they were either taken or they went into the sea. But you'd have, the way the westerly winds are, you'd have expected the bodies, if they'd gone into the sea, to have been washed up on the main island. But that didn't happen.
Well,
so
Keith,
it's a strange story without the bodies.
It certainly is. Keith McCloskey, the book is called The Lighthouse, The Mystery of the Elan Moor. Lighthouse Keepers, it's a wonderful story. I hope people will check it out, and hope you'll come back and update us on the Dyatlov Pass mystery as well. This book, of course, is a Christmas mystery, but it's not a story you would tell your kids around the tree, I don't think, and I'm glad you were here with us. And we hope you'll join us again. I want to thank my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Jeff Duray and Gina Salvati, our webmaster Lex Lonehood, Dan Galani, and producer Chris Boros. I'll be back next week. Merry Christmas to all of you. Hope you have a wonderful and safe holiday season. Good night, everyone.